Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Monday, April the 29th. As we like to do on Mondays, we'll be chatting with our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Obviously, the colleges and the universities are in the news. I've got my little TV here watching what's happening down in Austin, Texas, where the police is being very serious with the protesters. Let me say hello to our friend Bill. Bill, how are you? Have you been liberated yet by these liberators over at Columbia?
Well, No, for some reason I don't feel more liberated. you know, we've been through this before. We are a Columbia family. I have 3 degrees from Columbia in our household. But Columbia seems like a distant memory right now. We went through this in 1968. At Columbia, where they brought the police onto campus, and the president of the university was severely criticized for it. They should bring the police on now, because the police are much better trained today to deal with these things, and they would get rid of this problem very quickly. But they are the authors of their own farce, the leaders of Columbia. They keep on making these deadlines. If you don't get off the campus by such and such a time, you'll be suspended. Terrible things will happen to you, and then the time comes, and it just goes, and nothing happens to them. Now,
right.
They gave a final deadline today. They said at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, if you don't get off the campus, we're going to suspend you. 2 o'clock came. They didn't get off the campus. Nothing has been said. I understand from one of the television stations that there's going to be a statement made by the president of the university at 6 o'clock or something. People have gotten tired of it. I mean, this is no way to run a university. Students must adhere to the rules of the university, and if they don't, they get punished, as in any civilized society, but that's not a civilized society. They're under intense pressure, undoubtedly, from the hard left of the Columbia faculty, which is militantly anti-Israel and anti-American, I might add. They are under some other pressure from other donors who are fed up with the way the university is being run. I can appreciate to some degree the feelings of pressure they are under, but the answer here is a simple one. Get them off the campus, make your threat, and then carry it out.
Right.
And it's amazing how quickly things will disperse.
Well, I agree 100% with you. I think that somebody needs to represent the students who are not part of this, who I would bet to say are more than 80% of the students who are not participating, maybe more like 90%. And, you know, at some point you have to look out for them because their courses are being interrupted. In some cases, their graduations, which is, I think it's obscene that they would cancel a graduation because of this. At Columbia, their courses are moving online, which is obscene. You pay $70,000 a year. You didn't pay for an online class. You could have done that at home, you know. So it just seems to me like a bad example. But I will tell you, here in Texas, in Austin, Texas, they are trying to do something like this, much smaller scale, if I may say so. And the police is in, and they're physically removing them. And I hope they go through with it, and I hope this time these kids get thrown out. I mean, I say kids, they're young adults, get thrown out. But I just feel, Bill, that somebody's got to represent the interest or the point of view of the overwhelming majority of students who are not participating, but yet they're being impacted, Bill.
Well, the fact of the matter is that you're absolutely right. I mean, as a matter of fact, Columbia, interestingly enough, just last week, elected as the student government president, an Israeli student. And, you know, I mean, that represented the feelings of the students, the most of the students on campus, but the ones who are in charge of these demonstrations are some radicalized students, I'm sure many from off campus, and I'd like to know where the money is coming from. That question is asked over and over. We're not getting any straight answers. And of course, not only that, but these universities and Columbia, to a very large degree, get federal funds, get our money to help operate every year, and they then go out and violate our laws. And I'd like to know why the President of the United States has nothing to say. We all know why. He's under pressure from the hard left of his party, but it would be nice if the press secretary would get up and say, the president has nothing to say because he stares stiff, you know, and he hasn't gotten his orders from Barack Obama. It's just disgraceful for a president to act that way. We remember Ronald Reagan when he faced a problem like this at the University of California. He just basically read the riot act to them, and the demonstrations went away. You have to give them a deadline and then enforce it.
Right. Well, we don't have – I mean, I remember reading recently about that whole Reagan incident when he was governor back in 67, 68 back then, when he took very firm action. But we don't have to go back that far. We can look at Governor DeSantis in Florida, Governor Abbott here, Governor Kemp in Georgia. I mean, we have governors who are doing that right now. And I keep asking myself, where's the governor of New York? Where is the mayor of New York? Now, I understand these are private schools. I get that. But at some point, you know, when there's certain lines that you cross where you become a public problem. And I think that's very legitimate for the governor of New York or the governor of or the mayor of New York City to say enough is enough. If you're not out by six, we're going in and we're going to get you out. I mean, at some point, it seems to me, Bill, that you have to defend. I don't want to sound like a broken record, but you have to defend the interest of the overall student body that is not behind this and yet is being hurt by this, Bill.
Of course, but it is a private university, and from what I understand, they would have to have a written request from Columbia and then possibly even more authority for the police to go onto campus. And that has not been issued yet. Columbia has not made any request for the police. In fact, they've said they're not going to call the police because they got a complaint from 1,000 hard Leninists around the academic world that this was not in keeping with the university. Yes, it is. Universities are supposed to keep their rules. They're supposed to protect their students. But the hard left is very powerful. It's very powerful in the academic world, and it's powerful now in the Democratic Party. And they're the ones who are preventing this problem from being solved very quickly.
Yes. Well, Bill, remember back during the Clinton campaign, the first time that he ran, that there was something called a sister soldier moment?
Yes.
Where he confronted I guess she was an entertainer. I think that's what she was. I don't remember.
Her name was Sister Soldier.
That's right, and I guess she said something obscene and racist, and then Governor Clinton confronted her and said, no, I don't want people like you voting for me, or something like that.
Yes.
And he benefited politically from it when he did it, and I keep thinking that this would be a perfect moment for a similar situation for President Biden to say, no, I don't support this, and we're not going to allow for Jewish students or Israeli students or whatever in our universities to be threatened. Now, a lot of Democrats are saying that, but it carries a lot more water when the president does it than a senator, because the senator cannot do anything other than give a speech, Bill. But the governor or the president can at least mobilize the National Guard or at least put some pressure on the university to do something, Bill. I mean, I'm actually astonished that I'm watching stuff like this on TV. I don't remember. I mean, I remember the demonstration of Columbia back then, but not as well as you do, probably. But that was a one issue. I guess it was Vietnam, right, that they
Vietnam
were demonstrating
War,
about. But I don't know. I just felt that was a totally different Democrat Party back then, too, Bill.
Oh, a completely different party. There was, in the party then, a left-wing element that was opposed to Lyndon Johnson, in part because he wasn't Jack Kennedy. but there was not the kind of hard leftists as in the squad in the Democratic Party today. These are quasi-Marxists. They are very, very anti-Israel. They're, to be perfectly blunt, they're anti-American. That's the part that a lot of people don't want to talk about. I've been switching back between CNN and Fox. CNN has respectable coverage, but they soften it quite a bit as compared to Fox, which tells you the blunt truth about who these people are. I mean, these individuals who encourage college students to violate the laws of their university.
Yeah. No, I don't get it either. I don't get it either. But I'm glad to see that the Governor DeSantis, as well as the president of the University of Florida, you know, the former senator who became,
Sass.
I think Sassy was his name, or Sass,
Sass,
whatever.
Yes.
Yeah. He's been very clear about it. And here in Texas, I think Governor Abbott is doing the right thing. I don't know how much he's involved with this, because this could be more of a local decision than a governor's decision. But I'm glad what they're doing in Austin. At least they're saying you have a deadline to get out, and if you don't get out, we're going to get you out. The other thing, too, that is happening down here, I don't know how much you've seen on television, is that they were told last week that they were not going to set up these little tents. You know, they were told last week, you can march at the park, we'll give you a park, and you can scream all you want, but you cannot set up these little tents like they're doing in Columbia. Well, I guess one of them decided to set it up, and the police said no. And they literally moved it, and now they're, as I understand, the last report that I saw is that they're going in and they're physically removing these screaming students who are calling out all kinds of names as if they were actually living under a dictatorship, Bill. That's what amazes me.
Oh, yes.
These people screaming dictator, and they don't even have a clue what a dictator is, Bill.
No, they're like little children. They are just incredibly immature, and so are some of the faculty members, by the way. I mean, it's unbelievable the level of immaturity that exists on these campuses, and Columbia is considered an elite campus. It's one of the Ivy League schools. And for goodness sakes, if these are our elite students, we're in a lot of trouble. But from what I am reading, many businesses now have become fed up with the Ivy League and all these prissy little kids who get a job coming out of college in their corporation and then decide whether they want to do the work or not. I've heard many complaints from corporation executives who said they've had it with these, you know, prestige schools. So I think we may be making some progress in a number of areas.
Well, the other thing, too, I read, and I cannot quantify this, but I read that many parents or many students are actually opting for going to other schools, like, for example, universities in the South, where you can get an education and you can concentrate on watching football games on Saturday and having parties on Saturday nights and going back to school on Monday, and you don't have to put up with all this political stuff, Bill.
That's exactly right. I mean, there are now real recruiting efforts, apparently, on the part of schools in the South and the Midwest to recruit students who ordinarily would apply to Ivy League schools. And more power to them. More power to them. There are some very fine schools around the country that don't have this kind of problem. And if I were a parent today of a college student, that's where I'd want my child to go.
Well, at least you're not going to get a phone call from your child telling you, send me some money to get out of jail.
That's right. That's right.
Because that's not tolerated down here. But they were asking one of the reporters down here, they were asking the reporter how many of these students or how many of these people protesting are actually students. And many of them are not. Many of them are not students. They're just your rotating protester who goes to here and he goes to there, and there's a place where they can pick up all the flags, like we were talking about the other day. Who's got the flag concession? Because that guy is making a lot of money these days. But somebody's putting up the money, putting up the placards, and encouraging these people to come to Austin to protest. So who's paying their hotel? Who's paying their airfare? This is a full-blown business, and I wish we had a media that would actually get to the bottom of that, Bill.
Well, that's it. The media is a joke. I mean, with the exception of Fox, which has been doing a pretty good job, there is no real interest in getting to the bottom of anything, unless it will embarrass Donald Trump. You know, that's you get CNN, which is the anti-Trump network. They have been covering this story. Some of their reporters are good. They've given some useful information. But in the end, they really are not going to go very deeply into what the protesters actually stand for. These protesters, first of all, half of them probably don't know where Palestine is. And when they say the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, ask them what river and what sea. They don't know.
Right.
I mean, they were dragged into this movement. They probably are there because a friend was there. But there is no great incentive for the majority of news organizations to ask tough questions because they're embarrassing their side of the politics.
That's right. Well, they should ask them when they talk about Palestine. Maybe they think they're talking about Palestine, Ohio, because there is a river, I believe, near Palestine, Ohio. So
yes.
It's embarrassing. It is embarrassing. And I don't know what to think of the president of Colombia. I didn't know who this lady was 2 weeks ago, Bill, so I'm going to try to give her the benefit of the doubt. If you're going to issue deadlines, don't keep, you know, pushing them forward. If you said they're out by two, they're out by two. It's like the old line by, who was it, Napoleon, who said, if you said you're going to take Vienna, take Vienna.
Take Vienna, right. Don't say that to a Columbia student. They don't know where Vienna is. But
that's true. They think it's Vienna, Virginia.
Yes, is that a kind of cheese, Vienna cheese? Yes, I think it's a kind of thing. I'll call my mommy and find out.
Right.
Yes, that's absolutely true. The president of Columbia was, I think, a surprise choice. She came, I think, from the London School of Economics. She is Egyptian-born. She is an Arab-American, which is, you know, an awkward situation in certain respects in a situation, in a confrontation like this. This is really the first crisis she has faced in Colombia. She has not handled it well, but I don't know if it's she who isn't handling it well or the Board of Trustees, which is pressuring her.
Right.
We don't know the whole story. We really don't.
Right. We don't know how. The other thing is, I wonder how much authority they have.
Yes.
That's the other thing. I don't know how these universities operate, but I don't know how much authority she has to issue demands or to enforce demands, because the reality is that without the police, it's very difficult to enforce anything, Bill.
Well, that's it. And the police in New York City, even if they were given permission to go in and arrest these kids, they'd be out on the street in an hour. Because this is New York City. The legal system in New York is a farce. It's the same legal system that's persecuting Donald Trump. I mean, run by this guy Bragg and by money from George Soros. New York is gone really way down. It's gone way down the drain. And as I said, even if they arrested these kids, they'd be out demonstrating within a couple of hours.
Right. No, it is sad to see everything going on. Well, you mentioned President Biden. Some polling data came out over the weekend. You now have three different polls, CNN, New York Times, and another one, basically saying the same thing, that Americans view the Trump presidency in a more positive light, that people are kind of saying, yeah, it was pretty good under him. And that's a remarkable achievement, I think. That is just a remarkable turnaround, considering all the negative publicity and all the negative attacks on Trump, that people are saying, no, he wasn't so bad. It's just remarkable that he's been able to overcome the avalanche of coverage, Bill.
It is, and let's see now what happens in the coming months. You know, it ain't over until it's over. Right now he is leading somewhat in the polls. I think it's perfectly fair to say, it's not disparaging really, to say that if the Republicans had a better candidate who did not stir up the dislike that Trump stirs up, they might be ahead by 10 or 20 points.
Yeah, I agree with that. No, I totally agree with that, because you know, in the poll, it says that he's more unpopular than Carter. And what happened to Carter? He lost you know, by a lot. And so the fact that this election, in at least the popular vote, is within a margin of error tells you that there are concerns about Donald Trump. And, you know, and we cannot overlook those concerns because they're real concerns of people who just don't like him, who probably maybe would vote for a third party if there was an option for that bill. I don't think they're going to vote for Biden either. So it's a mess. This election is going to be a mess. A lot of people are going to vote and go home and watch a movie, Bill.
I think that's true. Or pack and go to some other country.
I guess depending on the outcome, that could happen, yeah. But
Or enroll at Columbia University to fill some of the empty seats that they're going to have.
Well, maybe they're going to have as many empty seats in New York, Bill, as they're going to have, or empty seats at Columbia as they're going to have in some of those buildings in New York. I saw that a big building was sold at a huge loss to the investors. The business climate in New York, not exactly a good one these days, Bill.
Not at all. Not at all. It's a business-unfriendly city.
Yes.
I mean, it's run by the hard left. The board of trustees, but the city council, which is five blocks from Ground Zero, is almost all left-wing. There are some mm-hmm. Republicans, but it is almost all left-wing. Some of them are very anti-American. It's New York. It has that problem. It has that history. There are many, many New Yorkers who don't follow that line. But unfortunately, the majority on election day go in and they just hit the Democratic Party lever automatically, no matter who's running.
Well, of course, you're not going to hear this on NPR tonight because that is such a left-wing network. I'm having a little bit of fun with NPR, to tell you the truth, Bill, because now they're reporting that they have a problem with their audience. And the problem is that too many white people listen to NPR. That
yes,
they, you know, their audience is primarily a white audience, which is hilarious. You know, and they're doing all kinds of things to encourage, as they call it, people of color to listen to their network, but they're not listening. It's the same audience getting older and they're having a frustrating time having the biggest percentage of white people who listen to any radio network, Bill.
That's right. Well, they get the white elitists who enjoy things like NPR. This is fresh air. They say, oh, this is you. But black folks are having trouble paying their bills. They haven't got time to listen to NPR, to the white elitists saying, oh, our black brothers and sisters, they are suffering so. What shall we do about it? We shall report on it. And you know, NPR turned itself into a joke. There are suggestions by the Republicans that all their federal funding be cut off. They reply, we can get funding from another source. Then let them get it from another source.
Right.
Why should we as citizens have to pay their bills?
Right. Well, the idea, maybe you remember better than I do, but the idea of NPR when it came out, I guess, in the 60s, was to have good quality news reach many parts of the country that just didn't have any radio.
Yes.
And there were parts of the country, unfortunately, that you know didn't have a lot of radio coverage or a lot of news coverage. So they thought NPR would fix that problem. And I think to some extent it did, because I remember back in the 70s and 80s that I used to listen to NPR, and that's because that was the one station that you could listen to in an office building because it's an FM frequency, you know? And I thought that it was pretty decent, most of the coverage. You would get a lot of these hearings, like I remember the Ali North hearings, and I remember the Clarence Thomas hearings, and stuff like that you didn't normally get on radio back then because we didn't have the internet and all these other things. But I thought it did a good job then, but something went wrong with that network. I think it was about the time that Trump was elected. And it just seems that they've been on a left-wing direction ever since. And, you know, you listen to NPR right now, and let's say when they're talking about black issues, you think that we're living in the Jim Crow era.
Oh, okay? Yes.
Yes. You know, they don't talk at all about black-on-black crime and the impact that the breakdown of the family is having in black communities. When they talk about climate change, they don't talk about the fact that refineries in South Texas that employ thousands of Hispanics are going to lose their jobs because of the green agenda. So
that's right.
And so they seem so disconnected from their audience or from groups. And maybe I have a theory, Bill. I like to try this on you, but maybe it's because they, you know, when you sell advertising, you got to go out and you got to meet real people.
That's right.
And when you get when you get a subsidy from the federal government, it's just you get a monthly check and you don't have to worry about going out and knocking on the door and saying, hey, I'd like you to be a sponsor or I'd like to be an advertiser. Maybe that's what
that's
it is,
right.
Bill. It's just a theory of mine, but do you think there's anything to that?
I think there is. You know, when you don't have that responsibility to meet the payroll, you don't care about the payroll, and you regard yourself as terribly, terribly important. I don't have to meet a payroll. I am a journalist. I'm going to tell you about your world. Please excuse the gunshots in the background.
That's right. Well, let me go to a couple of other topics that I think are interesting. One is you mentioned the Democrats are divided by Israel. A lot of Democrats are jumping up, you know, up and down, saying, you know, that, you know, we have to stand with Israel. But the other thing is that the president was talking to the prime minister of Israel, and I don't know if President Biden directly said that we were going to accuse Israel of human rights violations, but the U.S. may be behind that, Bill.
It may be. I mean, I think that they would love to knife Israel in the back. I think they would love it because the people who run this administration are the Obama people. They never had any regard for Israel or for American Jews. These are a very different group. And I think they may be in cahoots with the International Court of Justice, which is a farce. It's not a court. It's a political body, which apparently is getting ready to issue arrest warrants for the Israeli government. And if that has the support of the United States, other countries will look at it and say, if America is going to do that to one of its closest allies, what are they going to do to us?
Right.
You know, we will lose all credibility as an ally.
I would love to see that vote in the Security Council, Bill.
Oh,
I
yes.
would love to see that council, because I think the lady who is the UN representative for the Biden administration would love to vote yes on that recommendation, resolution. But I don't know whether the Biden administration will let her do it, but she comes from the left wing, and she would love to vote yes, I bet.
Well, let's see what happens. It is hard to believe that with all the rioting going on at universities, that America would use this moment to knife Israel in the back. But that may be the kind of people that work in Washington these days.
Right. You know, Bill, you said something, and I wrote it down, and I wanted to get back to it for a minute. You said that people are getting fed up with this. I think that's what you said. They're getting fed up with these protesters at the campuses. And, you know, I remember back in 68 when Nixon, when people got fed up with the protesters that had benefited Richard Nixon as law and order candidate. And do you think that this could benefit Trump, where Trump really comes down hard on these protesters and especially the administrators? Because I think it's an administration problem that they tolerated this, Bill.
Oh, absolutely. Well, look, things are so mixed up right now that it is hard to know what anybody is going to do. The Biden administration has developed this 1-2 punch thing where they praise Israel one day and then curse them the next. And so all these organizations call and say, well, tomorrow could you make a positive comment? I think that Biden does not know what's going on. I don't think he really understands the policies that have been put in his hands by Obama. I think Obama would love to help the demonstrators at the universities who he sympathizes with privately. And God knows what could happen by the end of the week.
Yes, you're right. You're exactly right. I don't think that President Biden – this is something that concerns me a lot, and we've talked about it before. But when you have a man talking about cannibals eating his uncle
– That's right.
Years ago, and then the other day he said – that he was driving an 18-wheeler, and then the other day on that show, the Howard, whatever his name is, show, he was saying that he had saved six people at the neighborhood pool. You know, that would be an all-time record. That would put him in the Lifesaver Hall of Fame.
That's right. Look, this guy lies so much, and isn't it incredible that the press never calls him out for it? Unbelievable. It's blatant. It's blatant. It really is. I don't know how the press can explain itself away. Maybe they feel they don't have to. All they have to do is help him get into office.
Well, I can. If they don't want to explain it, I understand that, but they're losing audiences. I can tell you that.
The respect for the press has gone way, way down.
I agree. And, you know, when you have, you know, I saw a stat the other day that CNN averages like 500,000 people on a primetime program.
Yes.
Bill, you could run reruns of the Dodgers, Giants in the 1950s and get a larger audience than that.
You certainly can. CNN is almost that. I don't know. Who keeps them in business? Who keeps them in business? I don't know. Is it the international CNN? But they seem to have the money to stay in business and to pay high salaries. But I don't know anybody who actually watches them or takes them seriously.
Well, the international exposure is important for them because I know that in many countries, that is all they get is CNN international. So that probably does pay some bills. For them, CNN National, not many people watch. Well, let me leave you today, Bill. I wanted to start with this story, but we got into more important stuff with the campuses. But Duke Ellington was born on this day in 1899, passed away in 1974. I never met him personally or anything like that, but I grew up listening to him, not realizing that it was Duke Ellington. Or that the song that I was listening to was called Take the A-Train.
Take the A-Train, yep.
But my story goes like this, Bill. When we were in Cuba, at the end of our time in Cuba, my father would listen to shortwave radio, which is the only way we could get news. And the Voice of America was one of the ones that he would listen to. And they had a jazz program every night that would go around the world, very popular in the Soviet bloc back then. And it was a jazz program that would go all around the world on shortwave. And the opening song for that program was Take the A-Train. So
yes.
I grew up listening to that, you know, that introduction, that musical introduction. And I not realizing that the song was Take the A-Train, or for that matter, that it was Duke Ellington. But I remember that melody. I mean, I have that melody in my head, you know, sitting next to my father listening to shortwave radio, and my mother too, and my brother too, and, you know, my dad tapping his foot on the floor to take the A-Train. And here we are, you know. I that's all I know about him, but that is enough to give me a wonderful memory of my father, Bill.
Yes, yes. Well, Ellington was an important guy. He was probably the most prominent black composer in America in the first half of the 20th century.
And did you ever see him on The Tonight Show? I know that
there. Yes, I met him. I interviewed him. It was a very brief interview. He didn't have really that much to say. He was rather old at the time. But I did interview him. He was very, very gracious. And I came to appreciate later his music. I knew members of his family, especially Mercedes. A very, very fine family, by the way, and one that I think has upheld his traditions very well.
Was he involved in politics at all? Was he involved in the civil rights movement at all?
I don't know. Isn't that interesting? I don't know. We didn't discuss that, certainly.
Yeah.
But I'd have to look that up.
No, it's just that I never heard his name associated with the civil rights movement, like Jackie Robinson was, for example.
Very much yes.
Yeah, he got involved in it. But I never heard anything at all about, you know, Duke Ellington and the civil rights movement. And he would have been of that generation grew up at the time. And so I always thought, well, maybe he was involved or was a part of it, but then maybe he wasn't, Bill.
I do not, as I said, recall anything political about him, but I'm gonna look it up.
Yeah, because it makes sense to me because of the time that he lived. But all I can tell you is from a personal reflection, Duke Ellington, and it took me years to figure out who he was, And I didn't even know the name of that song, Take the A-Train, until much later.
Yes.
But it just took me a long – I mean, the memories of that opening, you know, that intro, that musical intro to that song are in my head. And every time I hear that song, I have this image of sitting with my father in Cuba. And my father had this Philips shortwave radio, and he was tapping his toe to Take the A-Train. And I had no idea that it was Duke Ellington or that it was that song, but it's the melody, Bill, that keeps coming back to me every time
I think
of my father, every time I think of that song.
Well, it's a great song. And you see there are tapped versions of it and other versions of it. Yeah, bum, 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 bum,
right.
Bum, bum, blah, 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 blah. Great song.
Did he write that? You said he was a great composer. I didn't know.
He wrote the music. I don't think he wrote the words. Let me see. So let's look it up and see.
Yeah, if you can. I know the melody is really it's a great melody. I mean, I love the melody. I love the melody, but I didn't even know there were lyrics to that song. But I know that there's a great melody, and I know it's a very jazzy tune, and that's the part that I think a lot of people love, but it's just it just reminds me so much of my father.
Well, now this is interesting. Here is a reference. Take the A-Train was written by Billy Strayhorn, Duke's co-arranger, co-composer, musical alter ego, and dearest colleagues for over 30 years. Several of Strayhorn's compositions were mistakenly credited to Duke, which was a common practice in the first half of the 20th century. That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, now we know the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would say. But it's still fascinating that the melody is so associated with him.
Yes.
And what's interesting, Bill, and one last thing about this, I remember meeting some people from Russia about 20 years ago or so here in the area. And they told me about the Voice of America and the jazz program. And they had the same memory of that introduction that I did, Bill.
Yes. Well, it's a great song. I did not know until I looked it up a minute ago that it was actually written by somebody else. But it is true that in that era, it was common for there to be mistakes in crediting. Let's put it that way.
All right. Well, we'll forgive Duke and everybody else.
Yeah.
We'll forgive him, but
He certainly is the one who advanced it.
Oh, absolutely. He made it famous. And the Voice of America, and I forgot the name of the host who used to do that show, but the Voice of America certainly took that song to millions of homes around the world who were living under communism at that time.
Yes, absolutely. Sure.
And that was the other great thing about that show. So many people around the world who became fascinated with jazz. And that song, I think for a lot of people, was almost like the equivalent of the Voice of America. That's what it was for
exactly
for many people. Well, Bill, thank you so much as always for your time. Have a good week, and keep an eye on Columbia.
I'm going up there to hand out hot fudge sundaes.
Do that, please.
Yes.
And I see here on my screen that the police is removing. Removing protesters, as they like to call themselves,
yes.
From Austin, Texas. So hopefully they'll remove all of them and put them in jail.
Okay.
Okay,
Bill. Talk to you next week.
Thank you so much, Bill. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure. Always
thank you so much, Bill. Our good friend, Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda, talking about the universities, and there at the end talking a little bit about Duke Ellington, who was born on this day in 1899. Thank you for listening. This is Silvio Castro in Dallas, and we'll talk to you later.